Okay, well, shall we kick off? Just want to welcome everybody to the London Aesthetics Forum, which is part of the Institute of Philosophy. First, I'd like to thank our sponsors, the British Society of Aesthetics, for their support. And second, I'd like to welcome today's speaker, James Hamilton. James is Professor of Philosophy at Kansas State University. He's known for his work in aesthetics and especially on philosophical questions concerning theatre and theatrical performances and their relations to texts and that sort of thing. Today he's going to talk to us about how to make sense of and how to answer questions like, did Hamlet just kill Polonius?
So thank you first. I have met one of you before and the rest not at all. So when it comes to the Q&A, if you please introduce yourself, say your name clearly and slowly. I'm an old man, not the only one in the room, but I am an old man, and as they know, it's nice to have it said slowly, and where you're from before you begin asking the question. You can go blindingly fast on the question, just go slow in telling me your name. So thank you. This is a bit unusual. I think of what I'm doing over in the UK and Spain and Sweden this month or so as finding out what's wrong with what I'm currently thinking so that I can go back to Kansas and figure out either whether it can be fixed, and if so, how to fix it. And today what I'd like to do is present to you a case for thinking about theatrical spectating using Bayesian learning theory. And so I'll begin. There's a background story here. The larger project is a project of thinking about the theatrical performance as an information transfer transaction, which means there's some sort of source. As a receiver, the sources are typically, but not, they don't just include what the performers do. The detector at the other end is the spectator. And what happens is some kind of information is processed there. I think of information because I'm interested in what we understand as spectators, what we do when we interpret, what we do when we appreciate a theatrical performance. I think of information as having to do with beliefs or belief-like states. And so I think of information, I think something like this, a spectator gains information if her uncertainties about what's going on before her are reduced. Even if that generates further uncertainties, just figuring out what's going on in front of her gets reduced, and she's no longer quite as surprised by the next thing that happens as she was a moment ago. So, that said, there have to be two pieces to this. There's an account of spectating, which I'm going to talk about today, and an account of performing, which I'm going to talk about tomorrow at 12:30 in this very room, apparently. So, let me say a little bit about that before I go on to the spectating, which is the stuff for today. I think the account of performing that we need already, at least the core of it, already exists and has existed since the late 70s, early 80s, when performance theorists, primarily in the NYU circle of Richard Schechner, began to look at what was going on in ethology and anthropology and began to ask, how does the display behavior that's recorded there tell us something about what a human performer is doing? That started the performance theory. Material began to get sidetracked pretty quickly by political matters. Schechner called for an end to theater departments and transforming them all into performance studies departments. This produced the predictable kind of backlash, both intellectual and bureaucratic. But also, he and a group of people around him and those that were influenced both by that strain and by the strain from Judith Butler on the other side, we're focused on authentic performances. It's a very 60s kind of thing, and it really sidetracked the view. It also led to some very peculiar metaphysical views about what actors do. Schechner at one point, and I'm not picking on him because he's an obvious target here, but Schechner at one point actually thought that when an actor in a performance enacted a god, and he was big on Indian performance rituals, the actor became the god. Whatever the heck that means. And it actually means just what you think it does, nothing. So it got sidetracked, but I think it can be revived. And if you come back tomorrow, I'll show you how I think it can. But today I'm going to focus on spectating. And I will also say that the general account needs to respond to two kinds of worries. There are those from information theory who think this can't be anything more than metaphorical. You can't actually make it literal. And I want to see how far you can and what other metaphors it might then generate for us to pursue. But I want to see how literally we can take this idea. But there are worries about that from information theorists, I would assume. But also from the side of theater practice and theory. And I'll mention some of those because they come up in terms of the theory of spectating I've got here pretty straightforwardly. So towards the end, I may articulate your question. I may just start a list that you will help me fill out. And that would be fine with me. So here's the plan. We all have a plan. This is the plan. First, I'm going to say something about the state of play and performance of theater theory, theater studies. Then I'm going to talk about three productions and the questions they produce or provoke. Then I'm going to give a kind of quick primer in Bayesian basics. This is for those who don't know Bayes, but also for those who do, there are some features of it that make it very attractive as a strategy for understanding spectating, which even people who study Bayesian learning theory, Bayesian updating, may not think about. And then I'm going to apply those basics to the three productions, and then I'm going to consider three kinds of questions. So here goes. This is an interesting comment about learning theory, development learning theory. And Alison Gopnik and, forgot his first name, Tenenbaum, wrote this in 2007. I'll just read it out. Over the past 30 years, we have discovered an enormous amount about what children know and when they know it. But the real question for developmental cognitive science is not so much what children know, when they know it, or even when they learn it. The real question is how they learn it and why they get it right. So I think pretty much the same thing can be said about theories of spectating in both philosophical aesthetics and in performance theory. Problems about the extant theories about spectating come in two kinds. I think they are related. But let me just say this at the outset. After a burst of information theory kind of thinking that came from semiotics back in the 60s and 70s. Whether that was the right theory or not, and I think it wasn't, the idea of focusing on spectating kind of got dropped. And it got dropped in large part because performance and theater studies focused on what the performers are doing. And they wanted to get a good handle on that. That's very different from the way it is in philosophical aesthetics, which has for a long time begun not with the producer of the art, but with the receiver of the art. And I'm going back to that. There are two main problems, two interrelated problems with the extant theories, and there are some now, happening again in the last decade and a half. But they still presuppose acting and responses to acting must be of the same kinds. They must have some sort of homeopathic or resonant similarities. Even those like Bruce McConaughey's, which is focused on using cognitive science to understanding spectating, think about spectating in terms of how it resonates, how spectators resonate with what they see in the performance. I don't see any reason to think in advance that we should assume the same kind of account can be given for both of these. And I certainly think as a theoretical matter, we shouldn't just presume it before we look to see whether or not it's true. The second kind of worry is the one that Gopnik points out with respect to cognitive learning theories. And this is also true of performance theories of spectating. Each suggests a reason why we spectate, cashed out in terms of what we get out of it, but none of them gives us an account of how that's supposed to happen. And that's what I hope to focus on and to see if we can make some headway with. So, here are some theatrical examples. See the handout. Okay. So the first is, I suppose you'll recognize these are from Hamlet 3-4. This is the first, is the first 38 lines of Hamlet 3-4. It's the shorter of the two. You will notice that in a standard production, between lines 10 and 12, there is a gap, and during that gap, Hamlet enters. That's what happens in a standard production. There's a second gap. In the second gap, in a standard production, the actor playing Hamlet draws a sword, thrusts it through a curtain behind which Polonius has hid, and then we get the lines that follow, and we assume Polonius has been slain. There are two things to notice about this, and that is, this is, even if you're not familiar with what happens in the scene, and I want to talk about the person who's not familiar with it. I actually went to a production here in London in the summer of The Rest is Silence, which was a very nice production of Hamlet, I thought, very interestingly thought out. But my friend who was had never seen a Shakespearean play before in his life, when he was 30 years old, didn't have any trouble understanding what happened. Not a bit. That's pretty interesting, by the way, that you wouldn't have any trouble understanding that.
Sorry, can I just get that straight? When you say didn't have any trouble understanding, you didn't have any trouble understanding basically.
That's exactly right, and that's all I'm talking about, is basic understanding. He could track that Polonius had been killed. He knew that Polonius had just been killed. It was a good question how he knew that. Another thing that's pretty obvious here, although it may not strike you as obvious until you look at the second example, is that there are speech prefixes here, okay, that tell us who says what. Who is saying what? And typically they guide a production because when the actors come to rehearse, even if they're just doing a scene, And they're given this as the script. One will play Polonius, one will play Gertrude, one will play Ham. Okay? And that's what's expected. But that, of course, is a convention of theater. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be done that way. And you can see that by looking at the second example. Now, this is very different. There are no speech prefixes. That's probably the first thing you notice. Many of the lines are the same. In fact, I used a good many more of the lines than from the first 38. But nothing is predetermined about who says what. In fact, let's just imagine this is a production in which four actors do something with those first three words. Maybe they make a round, maybe they just echo. Just think about the possibilities of what they could do. Then they do something in the first gap, and it could be a mime, but it could be just some movement in silence. And then they divide up the lines, sometimes one, sometimes two, sometimes all four. But they have thought through how to make this sound, and they will focus on the sound, and you will hear different rhythms, different sonorities in the production. In the second gap, there will be something, and I'm just going to say, let it be a representation of an unthinking act of violence. Doesn't have to be the miming of the killing of someone, but an unthinking act of violence. It should look like that. And then they begin with, oh, what a rash and bloody deed is this. And then in the third gap, and we have a third one here, they simply display themselves across, let's suppose it's a proscenium, if it's in the thrust, around the room, and they begin tossing the lines to continue making these sounds. The piece ends with, confess yourself to heaven. I don't know what they do. I don't want to prescribe what they do. I want you just to imagine the possibilities of a production. And now go back to the first one. And imagine, this is my third production, imagine that you have something that looks pretty straightforward. You know what's going on. You think you know what's going on. And then in the second gap, you begin to get the sense there's some tension going on. But in the second gap, something is done. Ham says, how now? A rat dead for a ducat? Dead. And out steps John Cleese and says, oh, I am slain. Now what's happened? How do we know what's happened then? Some will just find whatever happens in the rest of this completely baffling. Others will find it pretty funny. And they will not at all be surprised if later on, when Hamlet is referred to, when Polonius is referred to as dead, Cleese looks as though to say, not yet, really? See, here I am. You know, I can't do an English accent, so I won't even try that. But any English accent.
But that's exactly what happened in the Pyramus and Thisbe, which are quite famous, actually.
Yes. Yes, it is. And so your expectations are thwarted and you have to adjust. I'm going to come back to that point. Okay. So now here's some questions. One set of questions that people might ask about any of these. What will happen next? What kind of action will happen next? What are these performers doing over the course of the performance? And they may come up with an idea. But given that they have an idea, they might be confronted with something that doesn't fit. And so they'll be saying, well, if they're doing this, as I guess they are, what am I to make of the fact that they have just now done this other thing, which is inconsistent with what I expect them to do? Or they may be asking this kind of question. Why are they doing this? And if they are doing something where this is a kind of performance, as I'm beginning to guess they are, why have they now just done this other thing, which is inconsistent with doing that first kind of theatrical performance? The first set of questions is just about what's going to happen next, and how do I figure that out? This is what kind of thing is going to happen next, and how do I figure out what kind of thing they're presenting me? Those are very different questions. We often conflate them, but they're different, and I just want to point that out, and then let's move on to Bayesian basics. So the first thing I'm going to do here is give you some reasons for thinking a Bayesian approach is promising. The next is I'm going to give you a quick course on Bayes' rule, all the updating, and then focus on some features of Bayesian updating, which are useful to us. So, reasons for thinking a Bayesian approach is promising. Spectators are uncertain about what's going to happen next. They don't know. Okay? They need to adjust what they expect during the course of a performance. And this is true, by the way, not just of theater performances, but of course of dance performances as well. Maybe even of musical performances. We'll have to think about that a little longer. But certainly dance and theater. They're uncertain about what's going to happen. What happens, happens in time. They're presented with sequences of things they're trying to figure out, and they have to adjust during the course of a performance. They're frequently referred to, especially by performers, as either getting it or failing to get it. Well, what's the it here? One way to think of it is think of it as something static. But since they have to adjust to what they're seeing during the course of a performance, it's probably best to think of them as whatever the it is, as something that's producing what they're seeing over the course of the performance, something lying behind it that produces it. And it won't be something static. It's something that is changeable. Something I've argued for in a different context, I'm not going to try to argue for it here, although you may want to raise questions about it later, is that when you demonstrate you've understood, it's as though you had acquired a new skill or ability, the ability to describe it. That's just something I will insist on at this point without argument. The others I think you recognize as just true of performances as you've seen them. So the strategy then for the Bayesian is to treat spectators as learners under conditions of uncertainty. That's the strategy. How do we do that? Well, we think of what they're doing as updating, it may be beliefs, it may be expectations, it may be values they've assigned to variables. That may sound a little strange, but just think. If you're watching a performance, you're wondering what's happening to this character when this happens over here. Well, that's a little like, and I think it's a lot more than metaphorically like, assigning a different value to the variable that character. So here's the Bayesian basics. Bayes' rule for updating looks like that critter up there. Okay? That may be new to you. If it is, here's the primer. Take the letter H to stand for any hypothesis, whatever. And usually they're going to be more than one. You're trying to figure out what's going on. Is it this? Is it that? Is it the other thing? And so you're going to pick the most probable out of those. You're hoping to get the right story, the one with the best fit to the data, so to speak. In the case of the spectators, that's which description or narrative best fits what's presented. Okay? The little slash there means given, and letter E means the evidence, which corresponds to the data, or in our case, the features presented to a spectator during the course of a performance. Okay? Well, that gets some of those letters in that funny-looking formula. Some of the others are these. Wait a minute. Let me go back. Okay, so look at that formula again. You notice up here at the top, over on the left is something we're going to call the posterior, and over on the right is something we're going to call the prior. So let's take a look at what those are. The prior probability is the probability that some description is correct, some story is right, with before you see a lot of information, before you see much. That it is a narrative is one, when it may not be a narrative. That it is a narrative is one that many people commonly expect when they go to a theater. And so they're going to have that as they're going to assign a very high probability to that before they see anything. The posterior probability is what we're interested in. This is what we want to know. An agent's estimation that her hypothesis is correct, given that she's now seen some possibly further features presented, and in our case, that means...
Well, it's like, is the assumption that you're using here, or using Bayes' rule, that the spectator actually takes in and considers all the evidence?
Yeah. Yeah. All the evidence she has. Okay?
You know all that's available, or...
No. No, when I say all she has, I mean all she has, okay? There's much more that's available than any spectator will gain. And I think there are reasons for thinking, in certain kinds of cases, that that's reduced, and I'll come to those in a minute. Okay? But just all those she has. Okay? Spectator's estimation that a her hypothetical description or narrative is correct. That's what we want. And then, given each new bit of information, this updating takes place again, over and over and over and over again. Finally, we need an indication of the compatibility of the observed evidence with the given hypothesis. That's this guy up here, top of the line, probability of the evidence given the hypothesis. For many people, the probability of the evidence given the hypothesis might turn out to be very low because they just don't expect that hypothesis to be true. So their prior is low and their likelihood factor is also low, which means they're going to have trouble understanding. And then what's at the bottom of the line is the measure of the evidence itself. We assume that just sort of stays stable over the course of the performance, that is, the evidence. The bits of evidence change, but whatever is being presented is just whatever is being presented. And any hypothesis I make or you make is going to be using the same evidence. So the real differences between us are going to be somewhere else. They're going to have to do with our priors and our sense of the likelihood of the evidence, the compatibility of the evidence with whatever hypothesis we're entertaining. Okay, that means there's a lot of pressure on what's underneath, but once we get that sorted, then we can see how this is going to work. I'm going to give you a more complex instance just for a moment, because it brings out an interesting feature. Suppose you're looking at something that's happened, and you're wondering what effect this is going to have on a character who's not even there. So you have some evidence, and established from that the values for certain of the variables. You may wonder about the value. You may or you may not wonder about the values for these other variables, even when they're unobserved. You do not always do this, although you always update on it. That's kind of the interesting thing. You may not either observe those variables, you may not even think about them, but you will update on them. And that's a very interesting feature and seems to square with what actually happens. If, for example, you suddenly recognize that Hamlet has been carrying a bloodied sword throughout the closet scene, you may think back to that line, "Oh, what a rash and bloody deed is this," and reassess it. It may first have struck you as a mother's protestation that's way out of line, but by the end of the scene, it may seem to you to be exactly right. But you hadn't been thinking about that line. But you do retroactively update your assignment of its value. So here's the rule, and you know, it's just Bayes' rule in a different kind of case, but it's the same. All that stuff on the top over the evidence, the probability of the evidence gives you the probability that you're going to see values for these five variables, given that you have observed values for the other two. Okay, so I'm going to come back to that point just obliquely. I just wanted to show it so that it shows two things. You can do things besides straight up hypotheses and evidence. You can think about individual variables. And so they're going to be what level of abstraction you're dealing with becomes an issue. And interestingly enough, the Bayes learning theory is able to model how we choose among categories of hypotheses. And that, I think, is a real strength. So here's some features of Bayesian learning. We update all the values of all the variables at every observation. Everything changes once you've made an observation. You make a new observation, everything changes again. How much does it change? Well, under many circumstances, not a lot. In other circumstances, quite a lot. And that becomes a point of interest to us. You can make, as I've already illustrated, backwards estimations. You can make forwards estimations. You can project into the future what's likely to happen. You can project into the past what has happened and change your value of that. This will also help us explain why we often get correct hypotheses on minimal data. Spectators are actually pretty good at making some very broad stroke decisions about what kind of thing they're seeing on very little evidence. Why is that? Well, if they have a set of prior possibilities, that are constrained to look for certain classes of data and form certain classes of hypotheses, and the data, in fact, conform to that, they're going to make the jump right away to pick that kind of thing. And again, I'll just go back to narrative versus non-narrative. It doesn't take long before you recognize when you've got a narrative performance and when you don't. Okay? It doesn't take you very long at all. And one of the things that people who do this empirically do is they look a lot at infant learning, and they're really astonished at how quickly infants learn what a word is when they're only given part of the word. So they've got hierarchies at work that take the utterance of can, given the context, to determine whether it's candy or canasta that's about to be uttered. And they can recognize the word before it's even fully uttered. It's really interesting. Once they've learned the categories, they get it quick. They're very good at this. Why should adult spectators be any less good at it? That's all I'm thinking. Yep.
Just want to clarify what you do. On the backwards estimation.
Yeah.
What is it? I wasn't sure what level the estimations and evaluations are done. So let me give you a very quick example.
No, it's okay.
So Richard II, after Act One, Scene Two, most spectators will now have an eye on it.
Yes.
And they will have, when Act 1, Scene 3 occurs, it's going to be very different. But yeah, they're not re-evaluating or re-estimating what happened in Act 1, Scene 1. They're taking a different stance on Richard. because of what Gunnar John Gunter said in that one and two.
Yeah.
So it's, it, in a sense, in the psychology case, if you like, inference, theory of mind,
yeah,
it's at that level, not at a level of what happens.
Yeah, it is at a level of what happens.
So it is.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. They reassess what it was he was doing.
Okay.
So they're okay. This is the idea of getting it as the idea of understanding that when you do the Bayesian learning theory, what you mean by getting it is you're trying to figure out what's generating the data, what structure is generating that data, and your hypotheses about what structures it is going to change. And so I think we can, in fact, do this without talking about interpreting yet. Still talking just about understanding.
Ooh.
Yeah. Yeah, I knew you weren't like, going to like that. Okay. So this also explains why we favor smaller, more precise hypotheses over bigger ones. And this happens as the more data you get, the more pressure there will be on picking smaller hypotheses that fit all that data you've seen. And so there will come a point at which you begin to shut down, you begin to close down on what you think is actually going on. And it may happen fairly fast, but it may not. And the more you wait, the more you, the longer you see things, the stronger your sense is of what actually has happened and will happen. This allows for various sources for initial priors. And now I want to talk about the theory of mind, but also embodied cognition stuff. There's a lot of interest in the actual mechanics of how we do this stuff. But I think of those as sources of information or sources of constraints on what our priors are. And so I don't think the Bayesian learning theory is going to tell you what mental mechanisms are the right ones. It's going to be fairly open and fairly flexible about that. Choose your favorite story about that and show me how it constrains a spectator's prior beliefs or expectations or credences, whatever you want to call them. And then let's see what happens when they're given a production and see what they do by way of hypothesizing what generates that. That it may turn out that even if it's true, for example, as theory of mind people put it, even if it's true that one is pretending that what's going on in front of one is happening, literally happening, even if that's the true story, as a number of aestheticians, Greg Curry, for example, thinks. Nevertheless, starting from there, any spectator is going to have to modulate what hypotheses there are. He's just going to have to figure out what's going on. And so they're still going to have to do something like this, no matter what informs the priors. So I think that's a nice thing, but it also allows for the fact that priors can be constrained in certain ways. They can be constrained by our by old evidence. They can be constrained by new evidence. I could rely, and you're going to see an example of this in a minute, I could rely on my old evidence for trying to figure out what's going on in front of me and fail to get it as a result. I think that's fairly common with non-narrative theater. Fairly common. But we'll come back to that. And, well, we're there. It helps us explain why we stick with incorrect or unresponsive hypotheses. Okay? We just have strongly constrained low priors, prior expectations that this is non-narrative. Right? And so we just don't expect it, given the evidence, which is not going to change. This is why some people will also be baffled by John Cleese stepping out and saying, oh, I am... He's very, very angry when he says this. right? Oh, I am slain. I'm offended by being slain here. I'm not slain. See? Right? Over and over and over. So, but some people will just find that utterly perplexing. Why? Well, they have expectations about how a narrative is to go, and this is not it. Okay? So that's a simple way of putting it. And now let's apply this to the two cases we have. And how am I doing? Okay, I'm going to zip along a little bit now. But, I mean, it won't be too zippy.
Don't worry about it.
Okay, so in the first case, after the second gap, what do you suppose has happened? Well, your guess is just as good as mine, and we'll probably guess the same thing. Hamlet has slain Polonius. That's what we're going to guess. It can be a standard production, it can be a non-standard, straight-up narrative production. The rest of silence used pistols, not swords, right? I think for that scene, if I recall that correctly, I think they used pistols. And, you know, Polonius didn't hide behind a curtain, he stood behind a pillar. Big deal. Why, however, is this? This gentleman's, your name escapes me, but it'll come to me in a minute, has put his finger on a real problem here. What goes on in front of you is enormously varied. Right? How do you select it? Well, actors work very hard at focusing your attention where they want it focused. And they're trying to focus it on features of themselves and each other that they want you to pay attention to, not features they don't want you to pay attention to. So they want you to attend to the features you're using to try to give spectators a chance at figuring out what's happening here. Now, to the extent that they're successful at that, we have good reason to think that we will attend to the same features. Actually, to the extent that they're unsuccessful, we also have good reason. Suppose, think of the sort of worst case amateur theatrical nightmare you can. One of the ones that I think about when I think of this, and I've seen a lot of amateur theatricals, is the gun is not in the drawer where it's supposed to be when the actor goes to pick it up to shoot the other character. What do? Most spectators notice that something's gone wrong. They get it. They have a lot of sympathy, not just empathy, sympathy for the performers at that moment. They know something has gone wrong, and one of the things they do is they watch to see how they'll figure it out. Right? Will the actor just walk off stage to get a gun? Maybe. Will it go bang? Maybe. Any number of things could happen. You're going to watch to see how they do it. Why are you paying attention to that? You see right away something's gone wrong. Now, sometimes they're good enough that you don't, but most of the time, you see what's gone wrong. How do you see that? There's a lot to be looked at. You could be looking at the curtains, right? You could be listening to the people behind you rustling their program. You may actually be doing that too. But you will still typically pick out what everybody else is picking out because you recognize that's what you're to do. You're at the theater, you know that about each other, and you know that the job is figure out what's going on there. So you do ignore things that otherwise you would pay attention to, and you do allow them to direct your attention where they want you to. So we probably guess the same thing because we converge on the same features. But here's the other part. Just as spectators, we have nearly the same priors. We have a lot of different priors as interpreters of what we see. Some of us are more knowledgeable about the world. Some of us are more knowledgeable about theater practices, but just qua spectators, just as people trying to figure it out, we have pretty much the same expectations. And where we differ, things really can go haywire very badly in a hurry. So the second case, actually, as I wrote this, was the John Cleese case, so I'm sorry I've got them backwards now. But in the second case, why do some of us find that performance baffling, and why do others get it? Well, again, the stronger the constraints on your prior and the lower your prior, the greater your surprise at evidence that does not conform to it. You simply will discount that evidence. Okay?
Are you saying you notice it and discount it?
That I'm coming to. Okay? It's part of a Q&A part that I have the Q to. I don't have the A to. Okay? No, I know that's a very good question. Okay, but if you change your prior, that same bit of data will become quite expected and fit neatly into your adjusted expectations. So in the third case, why are people baffled? And why do others go with it? Well, some people have cognitive biases to forming their initial priors, right? And what, you know, the stuff that empirical cognitive scientists are really good at figuring out is what our biases are. And if you just Wikipedia'd, is that a word, verb? If you just put cognitive bias into Wikipedia, you're going to get over 150. It's amazing we know anything. Right? But some of them really stand out. Suppose you expected a narrative performance, and suppose this is because you've never seen anything else. Not only will your prior be, this is a narrative, but all the categories that constrain the priors are going to push you towards picking only among hypotheses in which there's a narrative element. So you're going to consider different ways the narrative could go, but if it's not a narrative, you're just not going to get anything. It's not going to happen for you. There will be updating, but it will be very minimal updating, nudging you very gradually in the right direction, but you're not going to get it for a long time, and maybe not at all. So the stronger the constraints on the prior, and the lower your prior, the greater your surprise that evidence does not conform to it again. And this is there are two features here. One's called explaining away, and the other's backwards blocking. This is a case of backwards blocking. Explaining away is more forward-looking, but it still relies on the same crucial aspect, and that is that since everything has to, all the probabilities have to sum to one, any time the probability of one hypothesis goes up, the probability of alternative hypotheses has to go down. Okay? And that enables us to talk about why you simply don't consider some hypotheses once you've gotten certain kinds of evidence. And it also enables us, and this is especially important about backwards blocking, enables us to see how constraints on the hypothesis set can shape what you're going to expect in such a way that you will not even consider the relevant hypothesis. It will just be blocked for you. So here are three kinds of questions that I think people can ask. And the first are technical questions about the applicability of Bayesian learning theory to spectating. I imagine that people who do a lot of theater are going to worry about this, but also philosophers ought to, I think. I've really been very cavalier, actually, about hypothesis category. So what are they? What are the guesses? And are they consciously made? And also, what's the evidence? I think I actually can sort of say something about what the evidence is. It's the features you encounter during the course of a performance, the features that you're presented with. But what the hypotheses are is something that I think is going to be different given different questions. And so whether it actually works is going to, is going to be a function of getting that specific enough it could actually be modeled and tested. And notice that all I've done here is a kind of conceptual mapping of what the territory would look like and why this might seem attractive to us. I have not actually tried modeling any of this, although I have it set up to work on. If I don't get shot down over here, I have it set up to work on when I get back with some people in computer science and in the psychology department. And another thing that could be worried is about the story that I have about the demonstration of understanding is like acquiring a skill. The skill or the ability of knowing how to describe. There are a lot of philosophers, you may be familiar with this literature, there are a lot of philosophers who worry about the knowing how stuff to determine whether knowing how really is different from knowing that and how different it actually is. Here's another set of questions about the adequacy of Bayesian learning theory. Here's a good question, which I got at the recent Theater and Performance Research Association meeting. How well does this view work when spectators are not just observers, but are invited to participate? And they are participants as well as observers. How well does it work there? That's a very good question. I don't have an answer to it yet. Okay? I just want to say, I mean, I know this is a good question. You may have more. Here's another one. How do we detect when it is appropriate to narrate as the demonstration that we've understood something, rather than merely describing it as though it were just a sequence of images? How do we know when it's right to narrate? And at what level is that decision made? Does it have to be made as part of the understanding? Or can it be, as it were, made subpersonally and acted on without it being a conscious decision? But we still have to, and that will depend upon how it is in fact detected. And then among narratives, how do we detect, for example, the difference between integrated and episodic narratives? Because those are really quite different. And episodic narratives can look an awful lot like mere description of sequences of events, but they're not. They are, in fact, narratives. So how do we do that? And then there are questions of a more theoretical nature about Bayesian accounts of human learning, okay? And if you know anything about the Bayesian stuff, you know these are big questions. Does spectating involve inference? I've been treating it as though it did. Updating is a kind of inference machine, right? How you go from the evidence to hypothesis. How you change the hypothesis based upon evidence. Is there, perhaps, something that we might just call perceptual knowledge? Something you just know by seeing without making an inference? And if there is, how does it figure into this story? Surely it should figure large into this story. That's a big question. Another is the biological basis question. And there are actually a range of questions about the biological basis of Bayesian learning theory. You can model things mathematically that take a robot hours to do, which an infant can do in a flash. The rate times are just really wrong, okay? Now, there are a lot of fixes, and some people do sort of data sampling strategies, make models that involve that. Some make models that are hierarchical. And they are getting now, the models, the computer models, are getting now rate times that are much closer to human rate times by means of these strategies. But it's still, you know, once you get a model, still don't know that's exactly how it actually is done in the biology, in the wet stuff in our brains. You have a mathematical model of it. I think maybe the model can enable us to know what empirical questions to ask, or can enable cognitive scientists to know what empirical questions to ask. That seems to be how it's working. But it is really important that there be some real connection between the mathematical modeling and the actual biology here, the neuroscience. And then, of course, there are alternative cognitive science programs that have gone on. There's theory of mind, there's embodied cognition, there are various others that people have been brooding about to try to explain just exactly what that neuroscience is. And any one of those is going to figure into the question about the biological basis of this in a pretty important way, even if we can get it to work. So, thank you very much for your attention. Now it's time for you to ask me some questions.